Last week we started talking about, or rather, we spent a whole session talking about what I termed the problem with Megillat Esther, the sort of the difficulty of the fact that Megillat Esther is a post-exilic text, and that it is written with the consciousness that the non-Jewish world is reading over our shoulders, so that you have a text and a subtext, right? You have the surface text that the non-Jewish reader reads and interprets in one way. And then you have all sorts of clues and indications in the text for the Jewish reader who is reading with a different set of ears, a different set of presuppositions about what's really going on here. Now, what we're going to do today, if you probably noticed the title of the presentation, it is Ahasuerus and the Will to Power. Hang on, let me do share screen so that we have the source in front of us. And what I'd like to do today is analyze what's going on in Megillat Esther in the setting of the stage for the unfolding of the entire story. And I'm going to suggest that part of what's being portrayed here in this first parak and a half, this first chapter and a half of Megillat Esther, is a really disturbingly alien and dangerous environment for the Jews of the Persian Empire. Okay, so we're going to start, first of all, by looking at Esther Aleph through Chet, which is the beginning of the Megillah. We already noted last week that the phrase Vayhi it was in the days of Ahasuerus, is already sort of sending a signal. It's a foreboding introductory phrase. It tells us that bad stuff is coming down the pike. Okay, so let's read through the description. It was in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, who was ruling from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces. Now, once again, that number, 127, Sheva Meslim U'Me'ah, is going to resonate for the Jewish reader differently than it resonates for the non-Jewish reader. What does the number 127 remind us of? Sara Imenu, right? It's the age of the matriarch Sarah. When she dies, she's 127. There's this sort of veiled foreshadowing that Estelle is, there's going to be a Sarah figure coming into the story. Bayamim we're up to Pasuk Bet. In those days, Kishebet, HaMelech HaChashverosh al Kisei Malchuto Asher B'Shushan HaBira, when the king Achashverosh was sitting on his royal throne in Shushan, the capital, Bishnat Shalosh Lemolcho, in the third year of his reign, Asa Mishteh Lechol Sarav Ve'Avadav, he made a feast for all of his ministers and his subjects, Chel Paras U'Madai, the armies of Persia and Media, Partemim means something like local governors, V'Sarei HaMdinot Lefanav, and the ministers of the provinces before him. In his showing the wealth of the honor of his royalty and the preciousness of the glory of his greatness, Yamim Rabim Shmonim U'Ma'at, 180 days. Now, I just want to point out in general, and we're going to see this in another couple of psukim. This kind of language is not characteristic of biblical texts in general, right? It's very purple. It's very purple prose. The wealth of the honor of his kingdom, the preciousness of the glory of his greatness. To the Jewish reader, this resonates as over the top. Right, to the Persian reader, that's perhaps fitting for the period and for the description of a royal entertainment. But for the Jewish reader, this is not like the rest of Tanakh, where the use of the word me'od, which just means very, is a big deal. Right, Generally speaking, the biblical text is very spare and very terse, and certainly not very visual in its descriptions. Okay, let's keep going. We're in Pasuke, verse 5. Uvimlaot hayamim ha'ele, and in the completion of these days, asa ha'melech lechol ha'am ha'nimtzaim b'shushan ha'birah, limigadol va'ad katan, the king made for all of the common folk who were found in Shushan, the capital, from the greatest to the smallest, mishteh shivat yamim, a feast for 7 days. Mishteh actually means a drinking party, because it's from lishtot, right? Not a su'udah, not a eating feast, but a mishteh, a drinking party. B'chatzar ginat bitan hamelech, in the courtyard of the garden of the king's house. Okay, bitan, again, exactly what architecturally this means, I am not qualified to say. But again, for the Jewish reader, this is going to strike a very discordant, sort of jarring note, because the Jewish kings don't invite. By the way, most Persian kings did not invite the common folk into their inner courtyard, for obvious reasons. The proper distance has to be maintained between the king and the people. There are several midrashim that here explain why the king is making a party after 3 years. This seems to be an inaugural party. He spent 3 years trying to put out fires all over his kingdom, over his empire, trying to bring people under control. And now he's having his inaugural celebration, hence this very lavish 180-day blowout, right? And a 7-day special party where he invites the people into his, basically into his dwelling place. Hul, karpas, utchelet, white and pale green and pale blue curtains is implied here. Achuz bechavlei butz, fastened with or held by ropes of linen and purple, al glili kesef, on rods of silver, v'amudei shesh, and columns of ivory, mitot zahav v'chesef, reclining beds of gold and silver, al ritzpat bahat v'shesh v'dal v'sochavet, on a floor of bahat, I think is onyx, shesh is another white color like ivory, dar and socharet or other colors, one of those intricate, beautifully tiled, mosaic floors with precious stones. Vashtia bichlei zahav, and I'm sorry, vashkot bichlei zahav, and giving to drink in vessels of silver, vchelim mikelim shonim, and other kinds of vessels. V'yein malchut rav kiyat hamelech, and the royal wine was as much as the hands of the king. Vahashtiyah chadat, and the drinking was like the law. Ein ones, none were forced. Hichein yisad hamelech kol rav beito la'asot kirtzon ish va'ish. Because thus the king had established from on all of the butlers of his household to do the will of each and every person. Now we're going to stop the share here for a minute. I'm just going to, give you a sense of what's going on here. In the ancient world, it's important to remember, and I'm sure if you think about it for 2 minutes, you'll remember this. In the ancient world, kings had life and death power over their subjects. The king said, "Jump, you jump." The king put a cup of wine before you. You were given a cup of wine from the king's feast or something to eat. Boom, you ate it. You didn't just eat it. You ate it whether or not you wanted it. You ate it whether or not you were full. You ate it. You drank it. You did whatever the king did. To refuse the king's hospitality is no good, right? Now, there's something off with this king. And this is one of the things that is going to be, I think, made obvious in the following midrash, which is extremely, extremely psychologically apt. The king has established pasukhet, which we just read, that that his butlers are to do the will of each and every person. And this sounds remarkably benevolent. Nobody's going to be forced, right? Hashtiyah chadat, ein ones. Nobody will be forced. You don't want to drink the king's wine, you don't drink the king's wine. You do whatever you want, right? You're going to have fun. You're going to have a fine time at this party. The Midrash Esther Rabbah says the following brilliant, brilliant statement. Lasot kilton ish vaish. Do the will of each and every person. Amar lo hakadosh baruch hu. God says to Achashverosh, right? You know, God observing the party says to Achashverosh, Ani mi yotze midei biryotai. I cannot satisfy my creatures. I can't do the will of each and every person, God says. Vatame bakesh lasot kilton ish vaish. And you want to do the will of each and every person? V'nohag sheba'olam, in the custom of the world, shnei bnei adam mevakshim lisa isha achat. Two men want to marry the same woman. Yichola hi l'yinaseh l'shnehem? Can she be married to both of them? Ela olazeh, olazeh? But rather, either this one or that one. One woman cannot be married to two men at the same time. Somebody's got to die first, right? Before the woman can be married to two men. And similarly, two boats that are coming into harbor. One boat needs a northern wind, and one boat needs a southern wind. Can the same wind lead both boats in at the same time? But rather, one boat will come in first, or the other boat will come in first. Limacham, tomorrow, shnei bnei adam ba'im lefanecha badin. Two men will come before you in judgment. Ish Yehudi and ish tzar v'oyev. A Judean man, meaning Mordechai, who isn't actually Judean, but that's beside the point. And a man who is a rival and an enemy, Haman. Yechol ata latzeit yedei shneihem. Can you satisfy both of them? Ela sha'atam meromem lize v'tzolev lize. But rather, you will elevate this one and you will crucify that one. Okay. In other words, what we have happening here is one phrase is pulled out by the Midrash. The king has commanded the butlers of his household to do the will of each and every person. Now, this looks like benevolence, but as we will see, Achashverosh is anything but benevolent. What it really is, in the Midrash is saying this, I think, in the most brilliant way possible, that Achashverosh wants to play God, right? He wants to be the God figure to his people, not in the technical, divine sense, but in the sense of Achashverosh, because he is fundamentally insecure about his power, and we'll see why he is insecure about his power, wants to make everybody happy. That's not the function of a king, to make everybody happy, to make everybody like him. It's not to play God. It's not to give everybody what they want. Even God can't play God. Right? The Midrash says God can't satisfy everybody. Human beings have free will. Human beings have their own ways of functioning. Achashverosh is exercising here what looks like a velvet glove, but there's an iron fist in here. This is a man who wants to play God. He is voracious for power. Okay. And God says, guess what? It's not going to work out for you. Because the same way that two women can't marry one man, two boats can't come in on the same puff of wind, right? On the same stream of wind. Two men are going to come before you. They're going to want different things and you're going to have to choose, right? You're not going to be able to satisfy everybody. You're not going to be able to play God. And there's no happily ever after for you. Okay, let's go on. The psukim continue. We're continuing the story here. We're back in the verses. Esther Pasuk Yud, right? Bayom ha-shvi'i, on the seventh day, kitov lev ha-melech bayayin, when the heart of the king was good with wine, which means when he was drunk, amar l'mhuman bistach arbonah biktav abaktah, zeytar v'charkas. He said to Mehuman bistach arbonah biktav abaktah, zeytar and charkas, shiv'at ha-sarasim ha-mshartim et p'ner ha-melech ha-chashverosh, the seven chamberlains who served the face of King Achashverosh, literally saris means a eunuch, these men were actually castrated so that they could serve in the palace, like not a job you'd necessarily want. Okay. To bring Vashti the queen before the king in her royal in a royal crown, show the common folk and the ministers her beauty, because she was beautiful. And the queen Vashti refused to come by word of the king, sent by the chamberlains. He refused to come. And the king got very angry. And his wrath burned within him. Okay. I skipped a pasuk here, actually. I left out a pasuk by accident. It says, Gam Vashti HaMalka Astamishtenashim. Also, Vashti the queen made a feast for the women at the same time as the king is making a feast. And here, once again, for the Jewish reader, this little interlude where it says that the king wants to bring Vashti the queen before him to show everybody her beauty. This is like a red alert, red alert, red alert moment. What are you out of your mind? Basically, what the Jewish reader says. Is this the conduct of a king to show off his consort in front of everybody, or will that not actually diminish his power? In other words, this is, how should I put this? The term trophy wife, right? This is the ultimate trophy wife moment. This is a person who thinks that by showing everybody that he possesses the most beautiful woman, they will be impressed with him. Of course, what will they be doing behind his back? They'll be laughing at him. Okay. And here I think it's important that we notice the following. If we look at the way that the text describes Vashti HaMalka, right here, it says in Pasuk Tet, which we, I'm sorry, which I accidentally did not include, it says, Gam Vashti HaMalka, also Vashti the queen made a party. Then it says on the seventh day he's drunk. And he sends for, notice she's called here Vashti HaMalka, right? He sends for Vashti HaMalka, who refuses to come in Pasuk Yud-Bet, HaMalka Vashti, right? He sends for Vashti HaMalka, but Malka Vashti refuses to come. The Gemara Megillah here analyzes the interaction between these two people. Is it, by the way, is this clear? Everybody gets this? Everybody gets what we're talking about here? Okay, so let's go back. And we're going to look at what it says in Masechet Megillah. Okay. On the seventh day, when the king's heart was good with wine. Atu, the Talmud asks, really? Ad hashta until now. His heart was not good with wine, meaning, do you mean to tell me he has not been drunk in the past 187 days? Just now he's drunk? So why are you telling me that his heart is good with wine? Amar Rabba. Rabba said, Yom HaShvi'i, and again for the Jewish reader, Yom HaShvi'i is going to resonate as Shabbat, right? Yom HaShvi'i, the seventh day of this second feast, Shabbat Hayah. It was Shabbat. She Israel ochlin v'shotin, that when Israel eat and drink on Shabbat, matchilin b'divrei Torah v'divrei tishbachot. They begin with words of Torah and words of praise, meaning words of praise to God. Aval ovdei kochavim she'ochlin v'shotin, but when pagans, when idol worshippers eat and drink, ein matchilin ela b'divrei tiflut. Tiflut, they begin with words of sexual immorality. Tiflut is sexual foolishness, right? Picture a barroom conversation, basically. Okay, what does that mean? V'chein b'seudato shel oto rasha. And thus it was in the feast of that wicked man. Halalu omrim madayot naot. These ones were saying, Medean women are beautiful. Omrim Parsiot Naot. And those ones were saying Persian women are beautiful. Okay, I'll just stop here. And I would imagine, I mean, I have taught this midrash to young women, women who are out in the workforce, a lot of young single women who basically roll their eyes when they hear this because they recognize this kind of discourse. When you hear a man say something like, I think Asian women are hot, or I think Black women are really sexy, what do you know about this man? Well, you know that he's not talking about women as people. He's talking about women as objects, right? You mean this 90-year-old Asian grandmother is hot? That 12-year-old Black girl is sexy? I mean, there's something wrong with this discourse, right? When you talk about women in this way, this is typical barroom, like low life kind of talk, right? And that's what happens when men are drinking for 187 days. This is probably not the first time this kind of talk has come up. Okay, let's keep going. What does Ahasuerus say? Amar lehem Ahasuerus, one of the most jaw-dropping statements possible. Ahasuerus said to them, Kli she'ani mishtamesh bo, the vessel that I use, eino lo Madayi velo Parsi, ela Kastii, is not Median and is not Persian, but rather Chaldean. Ritzonchem lirota, do you wish to see her? Amru lo in, they said yes. Uvilvad shetehe aruma, as long as she is naked. Okay, now here is Ahasuerus speaking about his queen, right? As I said, this does not make him look very good. But also, he is speaking about her in the most explicitly as an object. This is a total objectification. And of course, when he says you want to see her, they say, yeah, that's fine, as long as she's naked. Shebimidat. So the question that Chazal are going to address here is, why does this happen to Vashti? Why does this take place? Because according to the measure that a person measures, thus it is measured to him, meaning it's payback time for something that she did. Milame, this teaches us, that Vashti the wicked would bring daughters of Israel and strip them naked, and she would make them work on Shabbat. Hainu dichtiv, that is what is written later in the chapter. Achar dvarim ha'ele kisho chamat ha'melech ha'chashverosh, zachar dvashti ve'et asher asata ve'et asher nigzar aleha. After these things, when the wrath of the king Ahasuerus died down, he remembered Vashti and that which she had done and that which had been decreed upon her. Kishem she'asta, kach nigzar, just as she did, was decreed upon her. In other words, Vashti is being punished with this humiliation, objectification, bad treatment, because that's what she did to Benot Yisrael. That's what she did to Jewish women. She would strip them naked to humiliate them, and to make them work on Shabbat to make them miserable. There's a couple of lines missing that I've left out here. Vayiktsof ha'melech ma'od, and the king became very angry when she refuses to come. Amay dalka bekulehai. Why did it burn in him so much? Why was he so angry? And here we get the picture or the explanation that helps us understand why Ahasuerus is the way he is, and also why this conflict with Vashti erupts. Amarava, Rama said, Shalchale, she sent to him, she sent a message to him. Bar ahoraire d'aba, son of father's stable keeper. Am balekavel alfa chamrashate belorave. Abba could drink 1,000 wines and not get drunk. Bahu bavra ishtite bechamre. And this man becomes foolish in his drunkenness. Miad, immediately, v'chamato ba'arabo, and his wrath burned within him. Okay, so what's going on over here? This is a dialogue about power. Okay, Ahasuerus is the son of Vashti's father's stable keeper. Who is Vashti's father? Vashti's father is Belshazzar, the last Chaldean king. This is after the fall of the Chaldean Empire. The story of Ahasuerus and this Purim story is after the fall of the Chaldean Empire. Vashti is royalty, and Ahasuerus is not royalty. In other words, when it says, and let's go back to that screen share here, go back to the verses, when it says, Vashti the queen made a feast, and the king sends for Vashti the queen, right? She answers as Hamalka Vashti, Queen Vashti. In other words, the difference between them is by blood, by heritage. Vashti is the queen. She's the daughter of Belshazzar, the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Ahasuerus is a commoner who used the confusion of the dissolution of the Chaldean Empire to wrest power. And he spends 3 years putting out all sorts of fires in his taking control of the kingdom. But in calling her to come before him, he wants to humiliate her. He wants to say, you're Vashti Hamalka. You are queen because I am king. And what does she say in refusing him? You are king because I am queen. I'm your legitimate claim to the throne. If you were not married to me, you would have no power, right? You're not royalty. And this explains, of course, why he doesn't act like royalty. He's not born to the throne. He doesn't feel secure in that role. He knows how to seize power. He doesn't know how to use it. But that's what he craves. That's what he wants. Okay. So what happens next is, ladies, well, let's go on to, sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I keep doing that. My apologies, but that's what happens when you teach women. Okay, so let's go on to the rest of the parak here. And I will take questions in a bit, okay? The queen Vashti refused to come by word of the king in the hands of the by the hands of the chamberlains. And the king got very angry and his wrath burned within him. And the king said to the wise men, those who know the new astrology, basically, because thus was the word of the king before all who knew dat, that means constitutional law, and din means law. And here I just want to point out something. If you remember the story of Henry VIII, who kept knocking people off left, right, and the wives, actually, wives, other people too, but his wives, you didn't want to be his wife. He kept knocking off wives one after another, those that didn't die. You can't just kill a queen, especially a hereditary queen. Think about this for a moment. And she's got the claim to the throne. She has royal status. Right? You can't just knock her block off. You can't just get rid of her, right? You can't just do that. There are even in, and notice the word dat, which is used throughout the story of Megillat Esther, it's not a completely arbitrary king rules situation. There are laws, even constitutional laws, you could argue, that are part of the that are part of the Persian, if you will, the custom. Laws, constitution, whatever you want to call it, you can't just kill a queen, right? She refused him. That creates a dangerous situation for her. But she doesn't seem to be afraid to refuse him. She does not expect to die over this, right? So here in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Sheitar ad Matat Tarshish Meretz Mar Sena Memuchan. The closest to the king were these seven people. Shiv'at Sarei Paras U'Madai, the seven ministers of Persia and Media, Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, the ones who saw the face of the king, Hayoshvim Rishona B'Malchut, who sit in the first row of the kingdom, meaning this is his kitchen cabinet. These are the people that he relies upon. Kidat Malasot B'Malka Vashti, because all of a sudden now she's Malkat Vashti, Malka Vashti, right? For the law or the constitutional ruling of what to do with Queen Vashti, because she is royalty, he can't just kill her. Al asher lo estat ma'amar ha'melech ha'chashverosh b'yad ha'sarisim, because she did not do the word of King Ahasuerus by the hand of his chamberlains. Now, again, think about this for a moment. You're working in an office and the boss gets really, really mad at somebody and starts yelling, right? And you know that it's going to blow up and you know that they're going to turn to you and ask you for your advice. What does a smart person do at this point? Take a bathroom break, go make a cup of coffee, be somewhere else. Because when a powerful person gets angry, you don't want to be anywhere near this seat. Because if you side with the boss in his anger and it backfires on the boss, who's going to get blamed? You. And if you try to defend the person that the boss is mad at in his anger, what's going to happen? Who's going to get blamed? You. What does a wise person do in a situation like this? Keep your head down, find an excuse not to be there. If you can't avoid being there, avoid answering, but don't get involved. This is a dangerous situation. Now, when we're talking about kings, we're talking about a person who has life and the power over his subjects, right? Because remember, Vashti has protected because she's a queen, but nobody else really does, right? You don't want to be there. Okay, so what does the pasuk say? Vayomer Memuchan lifnei haMelech v'haSarim. Memuchan said before the king and the ministers, "Lo al haMelech levado avta Vashti haMalka." Notice he does not call her haMalka Vashti; he calls her Vashti haMalka. Not to the king alone has Queen Vashti, as Vashti the queen sinned. Ki al kol haSarim, al kol haAmim, asher b'chol medinot haMelech haChashverosh. But to all of the ministers, all of the peoples, and in all of the provinces of King Ahasuerus, because the word of the queen will go out to all of the women to cause them to disgrace or despise their husbands in their eyes. In their saying that King Ahasuerosh said to bring Vashti the queen before him and she did not come. Hayom hazeh tomarna sarot paras u'madai asher shamu et dvar ha-melkah l'chol sarei ha-melech. And this day, this very day, the wives of the ministers of Persia and Media who heard the word of the queen will say to all of the ministers of the king that they don't have to obey them, u'chidai bizayon. There will be a lot of disgrace and anger. If it is good for the king, let a royal word, a royal writ come out from before him, and let it be written in the constitutional law of Persia and Media, and it will not be violated. Asher lo tavo Vashti lifnei haMelech. Notice she's not Malka or anything, right? She's just Vashti. That Vashti did not come before King Ahasuerosh. Malchuta yiten haMelech lichuta hatova mimena, and her royalty will be given. The king will give to a peer of hers who is better than her. Benishma pitkam haMelech asher yase bechol malchuto ki rabahi. And the word of the king will that is to be done will be done in all of his kingdom, which is great. וכל הנשים ייתנו יקר לבעליהן מפני מגדול ועד קטן. And all the women will give respect to their husbands from the great to the small. Now, we're used to thinking of this as quite comical. It almost sounds overblown, silly, crazy. He's magnifying her sin. He's doing something incredibly, incredibly dangerous, right? He's taking a big risk. And he's stroking the king's ego, but what he's doing is very fraught. It's very, very problematic. Now, notice I just want to point out here that getting rid of Vashti, this thing that I sort of highlighted here, getting rid of Vashti will require a rewriting of some basic laws of Persia and Media. And those of you, again, are familiar with the story of, or the history of Henry VIII, know that in order for him to get his way to marry the woman he wanted to marry, Anne Boleyn, he had to actually create a new church, right? He had to declare himself, he actually had to, you know, change the Anglican church, create the Anglican church so that he could get away with this because the Pope wasn't going to let him divorce Catherine of Aragon. Haman is, or Memuchan is taking a very great risk. And here the Gemara in Megillah sort of asks the question that we have to ask here. Vayomer Memuchan, Memuchan said, Tana Memuchan ze Haman. We learn that Memuchan is Haman. V'lama nikra shmo Memuchan. And why was his name called Memuchan? Shemuchan lepuranut, because he was ready for punishment. Amar Rav Kahana, Rav Kahana says, Mikan sheheidyot kofetz barosh. From here, we learn that the person who, the commoner, jumps to the front. Now, here, what I just want to point out, if we go back to the psukim, we get a list of the seven in this pasuk here, the seven ministers of Persia and Media, the ones who have instant access to the king, and they are Tarshanash, Shetar, Admata, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena. The last is Memuchan. Everybody else keeps their mouths shut. Memuchan makes a leap here. And the Midrash asks the following question. This is from Esther Rabba. And Memuchan said before the king and the ministers, what did Memuchan see, or what was the point of Memuchan to jump in with his advice first? As we said, the smart person here keeps their head down. And then it quotes the Masechet Megillah. From here, we learn that the commoner jumps to the front. Rabbi Yochanan says, Tlata Amoraim. There are three Amoraim, the sages of the Talmud, give three different opinions. What motivates him to do what he does? Had Amar, one of them says, because Vashti would strike him on his face with her slipper, with her shoe, like this. Okay, in other words, Vashti would physically assault Haman. V'charina Amar, and another one says, Al yidei shelo hizmina et ishto l'seudat nashim, because she did not invite his wife to the feast of the women. V'charina amar, and another one says, al yidei shehayta lo bat v'haya mevakesh lahasiya l'malchut, because he had a daughter and he sought to marry her off to the king. And each of these opinions brings a different pasuk to support their opinion. But what I want to do is look at what's going on here, because after all, again, we keep fighting against that preconception of Megillat Esther as somehow a mildly comical children's story. Nothing here is terribly serious. Why would Haman, Memuchan, take this terrible, terrible risk, because it is a terrible risk. If it backfires on him, he's in terrible trouble. Well, the first opinion tells us that Vashti used to slap him with her shoe. What does that mean? That means that he felt threatened. If a queen could show physical violence to a minister of the state, his life is probably not worth much. Right? If she can assault him physically, if she's assaulting him physically, she has signaled to him, I have complete and utter contempt for you. I hate you, and I am going to get rid of you, which might mean assassination. It might mean provoking the king to get rid of him. But in this case, it makes the most sense. What motivates Haman to get rid of Vashti? Well, he feels like his life is in danger, and what's he going to do? Get her first. This is an opportunity that he cannot simply avoid. The proof for this, by the way, is here in the use of the following pasuk, man de amar, the opinion that says, the opinion that says that she would strike him on the face with her slipper. She'amar, because he said, Lo al ha-melech levado avta Vashti ha-malka. Not to the king alone did Vashti the queen sin, meaning she sinned also to him. Okay, that's the evidence for that position. The second opinion says that she did not invite his wife to the feast. We know that even today, violations of protocol are a big deal because they very often indicate that a person's career is he's not being taken seriously in terms of his career. A few years ago, there was some sort of state dinner, and a chavrat knesset or a female minister of the government at the time was not invited to the state dinner, or she was seated maybe with the wives of ministers instead of with the ministers. It was a major big to-do. She made a huge, big, enormous fuss. And again, it made sense for her to do that. Why? Because it was a perhaps an unconscious act, but if it was a conscious act, it was a deliberate insult. It was an unconscious act. She was being not being treated as a minister of the government, but rather as the wife of a minister. And that, of course, is a threat to your career. You don't want that. So what we have happening here is the opinion that says, Uman da amal, and the opinion that says, Shelo izmina itishtoli lesudat hanashim, the opinion that says that Vashti did not invite his wife to the Feast of the Women, because she'amar, because he said, that the word of the queen would go out to all of the women to cause them to despise their husbands in their eyes. Adahi, from this we see, his wife wasn't there. He says the word of the king will go out, which means he's not talking about women who were at the feast who saw it happen. Okay, so here the motivation is he knows that if he doesn't get rid of Vashti, he'll never advance. He'll always be in the lower rung of the civil service, maybe even demoted. Here's his opportunity to step up. And the third opinion, man de amal al yedei shaita bat vayam la malchut, the opinion that says because he had a daughter and he wanted to marry her off to the king, she'amal u'malchuta yiten hamelech le'utah tova mimena, that the king will give Vashti's royal status to her peer who is better than him. Now, here again, what we're seeing, and I think that the Midrash is picking up on this, is that all of the relationships in this first parak and a half, and we're going to keep going, are all motivated by ego, struggle for power, position, status, even to the point that someone is willing to take a risk because the third opinion, the idea that he actually wanted to position his own daughter as queen, is a little, delusional almost. Don't take that risk for this outcome, which is in any event not certain. The point is that the only things that motivate the people here are dangerous motivations, cruel motivations. And as we are going to see, these are reflective of the society in which pagans are operating. What is it? What does it mean? What is the mindset of the pagan in this situation? It also helps us to understand this is really, really important, that when the Jews are exiled to Persia, it's not the land of the free and the home of the brave, right? It's a multicultural society, but it is not a benevolent society. It's a society that can be utterly overturned by the whims of a capricious and dangerous king, and that is being run by people who are wildly ambitious, dangerous people with no loyalty. There's no love. There's no appeal to humanity here in all of these situations. Okay, let's go back to our text, and I'll leave a few minutes at the end for questions. The Midrash, I'm sorry, the Megillah goes on. It says the following. I'm sorry. We have to go back to the Psukim. One second. Okay. The text says after this, hang on. No, I didn't bring the text. I'll just tell you what it says. Vayishlach Sfarim. If you have a Tanakh, you should open it to Megillat Esther, Perek Aleph. Pasuk. Chafalef. Let's start with Chafalef 21. The thing was good in the eyes of the king and the ministers, and the king did like the words of Memuchan, which is get rid of Vashti and find a different wife. And he sent writs, he sent scrolls to all of the provinces of the king, El Medina Umedina Kichtava Vel Am, to each province in its alphabet, its orthography, and to each people in its language, Liyot Kol Ish Sorer Beveto, that each man should rule in his house, Umedaber Kilshon Amo, and speak in the language of his people. Here Esther Rabba says another extremely shrewd thing. Writs were sent to all of the states of the king. Amar Rav Huna said, Achashverosh was stupid, basically. Serach means a smelly mind, right? His brain was rotting. His brain smelled bad. He was stupid. Why? Minhag sheba'olam, in the custom of the world, Adam mevakesh le'chol adashim. If a man wants to eat lentils, v'ishto mevakeshet le'chol afunim, and his wife wants to eat peas, yachol hu lechofa? Can he force her? Lo, no. Ma dehi baya avda. That which she wants, she does. What has Achashverosh been railroaded into sending out as a royal decree? That each man will rule in his household and speak the language of his people. Let's take the first part, rule his household. Your wife wants to eat lentils and you want to eat peas. What is the proper response there? Well, it'll depend on you, it'll depend on your wife, but probably the proper response is you eat lentils and I'll eat peas. Okay? You can't legislate that kind of detail or that kind of relationship in a family. It is not the job of the king to legislate such a thing. What she wishes to do, she will do. Otherwise, you can have a really miserable marriage. And if you force her to make you peas and you force her to eat peas, right, you'll have lumpy socks and, conjugal visits or whatever it might be. But it's going to be a miserable relationship. It is not the business of the king to try to legislate or to demonstrate his power in the private confines of a relationship between two people. There's a fundamental lack of awareness or willingness to see that human relationships cannot be legislated in this way. Amar Rabbi Pinchas, as to the second part of the decree, Rabbi Pinchas says, "V'lo od," and not only that, "Ela she'na'asas chok ba'olam." He became a laughing stock in the world. Achashverosh became a laughing stock in the world. Why? "B'no'ag she'ba'olam mitayin nosei parsit." If a Median man marries a Persian woman, he medaberet b'lashon mada'i. She speaks Median. Parsi nosei mada'it. A Persian marries a Median woman, v'hi medaberet b'lashon Parsi. She will speak Persian. Why? Because if a Median woman marries a Persian man and moves to Persia, she's going to learn the language of the place, and she will speak the language of the place. You don't have to legislate that. And if a woman who's Tarsi moves to Media or whatever language, whatever, there's a multicultural empire. There are a lot of different provinces, different languages. A woman moves to her husband's place of where her husband lives. She will learn the language of his place. Why? Because that's what she's going to do, or she's not going to have anybody to talk to. So do you have to legislate that? In other words, what this decree does is make Achashverosh look very, very bad. In fact, the Malbim says the foolishness of this decree, the waste and the stupidity of this decree, was what ultimately saved the Jewish people. But the Malbim is not the topic of our conversation since we're focused on the Midrash. What the Midrash is saying is, again, the same way that Achashverosh tries to overreach in playing God, he's overreaching and trying to show his power. So he ends up legislating something that can't be legislated or that he doesn't have to legislate, but he looks foolish. And what is also clear, parenthetically, from this situation is that Haman or Memuchan does not mind making him look foolish. To attain his goal of power, he doesn't care if he makes Achashverosh look like a complete. That doesn't bother him. He will trample all over Achashverosh to save the day for himself. Okay, we're going to stop here so that I can take some questions. And I will just quickly look through this. I'm going to try, ladies and gentlemen. I will try, but I'm not. One second. I seem to be on somebody else's. Okay. Okay. So Vashti married down. Was that allowed? Did they marry for love? No, they did not marry for love. I don't think we can see any love between these two people. Vashti marries down in one sense, but not in another. She has no political power because her father is dead, and the Chaldean line has ended, right? She is married down in the sense that she's married to a commoner, but she has not married down in the sense that the protection she needs or the status that she would want to have as queen can only be given to her by a person who has seized the throne. Okay. Women could not inherit the throne. We're not going to talk about Henry VIII. Can one talk about constitutional law in an ancient monarchical system? Yes. Constitutional law, not in the sense of a modern constitution, but in the sense of there are certain laws that king, even a king can't get away with breaking, right? Especially if you're talking about a multicultural society with a lot of different provinces and a lot of different people from different places, and you're trying to keep everything, in an equilibrium, right? To kill Vashti without some legal justification is going to get at least some people very angry. To violate the accepted legal precedents for kings by arbitrarily doing whatever you want, it's not going to work. Even Henry VIII, who was, you know, it's a later period in history. It's England, it's not Persia. But there are certain things the kings of, for example, didn't do. Even when Ahab, Melech Israel, wants to seize somebody's property, he doesn't want to start a rebellion. What does Jezebel arrange? She arranges a judicial murder. She has to frame Naboth to steal his kerem. There are things you can't do, even if you're a king with an enormous amount of power. Shoes are an insult in the ancient Middle East, and they're an insult in the modern Middle East too. You throw a shoe at somebody, you get your head chopped off. Vashti and Ahasuerus did not have a son. How does the decree square with the original law that people get to do what they want? Lasot kirtzon ish v'ish. That's Susan's question. The answer is the feast. At the feast, he's going to let everybody do whatever they want. That means if you don't want to eat the king's food or drink the king's wine, nobody's going to force you. But that doesn't mean you get to insult the king with impunity. That's not the same. That's not the same. This is part of the party setting in which you can do whatever you want. You can do whatever you want, you know, meaning you're not going to have to eat stuff you don't want. You're not going to have to drink stuff you don't want. How does Ahasuerus explain to the population that he killed the king, his royal line? He does not explain to the population. He simply enforces it. Can I explain again where we see that the king sees himself as God? No, I'm not saying the king sees himself as a god in the same way that Paro, the king of Mitzrayim, saw himself as a god, right? There was this idea in certain societies that the king is a quasi or a demigod. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, maybe this is a nasty way to say it. You know how people talk about doctors playing God? You know, that's a popular trope, right? Doctors like to play God. That's the sense in which I mean that Ahasuerus sees himself playing God, right? There's a, you know, famous joke, the doctor pushes his way to the line in heaven. It's a person wearing a white coat, and everybody behind him says, "What are you doing? What are you doing? There's a line here. There's the gates of heaven. You have to wait on line." And the angel sitting there says, No, that's God. He likes to play doctor sometimes." So, you know, whatever. That's the sense in which we're talking about Ahasuerus playing God. Not that he doesn't think he's a demigod. It's not clear that the Persian kings did think of themselves as demigods, but he wants to be a god. It does replacing Vashti necessarily mean killing her? It doesn't actually say this. You're right. It doesn't say, it says to replace the queen. I would say there are two powerful arguments for saying that he killed her. One is that he's not able to reinstate her when he regrets, right? When he stops being drunk, he doesn't consider reinstating her because she's not there to be reinstated. I think also because it would have been extremely foolish to leave a very angry queen with some sort of loyalty base alive, to be a mar to, you know, to be a fomenter of rebellion. Khazal understood it that she was actually killed. Does this weaken the women's role, this edict? No, I don't think so. I think the women's role was not particularly I, anyway. Okay, let's go on. Let me just see. Okay, I think we're going to stop here. Ladies and gentlemen, we will finish these sources because they actually lead us next week, Bezrat Hashem. They actually lead us into our next topic, which is the relationship between Mordechai and Esther and the ways in which that relates to the issue of power. That is central to the Megillah, and again, what that might reflect about our understanding of what happens. So we'll be doing this. If you want, you can say, I don't know if I'll be able to answer all questions, but if you want, you can send questions to my email address, which you can get from Rabbi Kelman, and I'll try and answer them if I can. Okay. So see you.